please welcome Texas Senator Ted Cruz.
Well, thank you very much. It is great to be with you. Good afternoon. Thank you for coming out. Thank you for joining me. Thank you for the incredible hospitality. Today is the first time I've been to Iowa, and I have to say it has been a wonderful day. I am struck by the commonality of values between Iowa and my home state of Texas. You know, I will also note, you know, we obviously have some friends outside who have a little different view than those of us in here. And I'm reminded of a few years back where I had the curious opportunity to travel to Berkeley and give the commencement speech at the School of Government. And it so happened that attracted protesters at Berkeley. They were very, very upset that I had defended the Ten Commandments Monument in Texas and the Pledge of Allegiance, and they were protesting. And my wife Heidi's comment upon hearing that is she looked at me and said, "Oh, goodness, you're not nearly important enough to protest." So, and every one of you who is married understands the tremendous role our spouses play in reminding us of our humility. And for that matter, kids do a good job of that as well. I remember back in the course of the campaign for Senate, one Saturday morning, I was home, it was about 6:30 in the morning, and was doing a radio interview. And we'd got two little girls, Caroline and Catherine. Caroline's 5, Catherine's 2. Caroline came bursting into the bedroom 6:30 in the morning. She wanted to play with Daddy. And Heidi jumped out of bed, ran over, grabbed her, pulled her out to the living room, said, no, sweetheart, Daddy's doing a radio interview. Just wait a minute." Caroline crossed her arms, and she stomped out, and she said, "Politics, politics, politics. It's always politics." And so I appreciate the commitment of each of you to politics. And even more importantly, the commitment to changing our country. Every one of you is here today because you understand these are not ordinary times. We are facing extraordinary challenges in this country. We cannot keep going down the road we are going. We are jeopardizing the future of this great nation. We are jeopardizing the future for our kids and grandkids. And in my view, the men and women in this room are key to helping turn the nation around. I think we should do two things in the coming year. Number one, defend the Constitution. And number two, champion growth and opportunity. Let me talk about both of those. Defending the Constitution. It is extraordinary right now, the assault on the Constitution that is coming from the federal government. This administration, the Obama administration, is sadly the most lawless administration we have ever seen. And I can tell you, in my short time in the Senate, over and over again, I have been blessed to have the chance to stand up and fight to defend the Constitution. Early on in my tenure, I had the great privilege of standing alongside my good friend, Senator Rand Paul, and participating in a 13-hour filibuster against the administration's drone policy. Now, you may not know that, but that was actually my first time ever to speak on the floor of the Senate. There is a tradition in the Senate that junior senators should be seen and not heard. I haven't entirely managed to comply with that. But I had respected the tradition that senators wait a reasonable time before speaking on the floor of the Senate, and so I hadn't gone up there. And in fact, initially I told Rand, I said, "Look, I haven't spoken on the floor of the Senate yet. I want to give it some more time to respect my colleagues." And then as the fight started, this was a fight I couldn't sit on the sidelines for. And so I had the opportunity. I went to the floor of the Senate to support Rand. And it so happened that the day of that filibuster was the 177th anniversary of the fall of the Alamo. And so I had the opportunity to stand on the floor of the Senate and to read Travis's letter from the Alamo. I had the opportunity to read Shakespeare's St. Crispin's Day speech. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. I had the opportunity to read the opening monologue from the movie Patton. Had to clean it up a little bit for C-SPAN. And I had the opportunity to read Ronald Reagan's 1964 A Time for Choosing speech. As they say in the beer commercial, it don't get no better than that. And what we saw that day, and I think it's important to look at what happened because it illustrates how the terrain on which we're fighting has changed. When Rand started that filibuster at 11:47 a.m., our colleagues thought what he was doing was curious, even quixotic. And as he stood up there and spoke the truth, one senator after another began to come and join him. And then the American people got engaged. Thousands upon thousands of Americans became fixated by C-SPAN, a phrase that does not occur naturally in the English language. With all apologies to our friends at C-SPAN who are here today. And thousands of Americans began going online, going on Twitter, going on Facebook, speaking out, saying, protect our rights. In the midst of the filibuster, I took to the floor and read from actual tweets that had been sent by Americans, which I'm pretty sure is the first time that's happened, which makes me very excited 20 years from now. If anyone has a political Trivial Pursuit game for geeks, I'll be the obscure answer of the first one to read a tweet on the floor of the Senate. And my favorite tweet that I had the opportunity to read was from a woman who said, I'm a grandmother. I've never used Twitter before in my life. And I signed up today to stand with Rand. And what happened in the course of the day is as the American people got focused, got engaged, and began speaking out, our elected representatives began listening to the people. And after 13 hours standing together, we were able to accomplish something that for 3 weeks the Obama administration had refused to do, and the next day in writing it did, which is admit that the Constitution puts limits on their authority to target Americans. Another example of defending the Constitution is the battle we had on the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms. Now, I'm guessing one or two people in this room may care slightly about the Second Amendment. You know, as you know, following the horrific shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, the Obama administration chose to take advantage of that tragedy to push an anti-gun agenda, not to target violent criminals, but to target the constitutional rights of law-abiding citizens. I'll tell you, I was very proud to work side by side with my friend and your Senator Chuck Grassley, helping lead the fight to stop that. Now, Chuck Grassley, all of you know his leadership, but I will tell you a couple of things about Chuck Grassley. Number one, there is no member of the U.S. Senate, bar none, who is more relentless and more effective on oversight of the Obama administration. And when the Second Amendment fight began happening, Chuck and I sat down, worked together, and we wrote together what became the lead law enforcement alternative to President Obama's bills. It was called the Grassley-Cruz legislation. And it focused on what I think most Americans want. It focused on violent criminals. And I think violent criminals, we should come down like a ton of bricks on violent criminals who would take the lives of innocent Americans. But at the same time, it safeguards the constitutional rights to keep and bear arms of law-abiding citizens. And once again, with the Second Amendment, it is another illustration of the power of the grassroots, the power of the American people. Early on in that battle, I have to tell you, it did not look encouraging. The president had a lot of momentum. Conventional wisdom in Washington was his anti-gun agenda was unstoppable. And what happened again is millions of Americans began speaking up, began calling their representatives, began going on Facebook, on email, speaking up. And we saw over the course of several weeks, and a number of us stood together and said, and indeed I joined with Rand Paul and Mike Lee writing a very short letter to Harry Reid that said, we will filibuster any legislation that undermines the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms. What that did was give time for the grassroots to engage. And when the grassroots engaged, when the American people once again demanded of our elected officials, stand up and do the right thing, protect the Constitution, you saw one after the other as the elected officials were forced to listen to we the people. And when the votes came on the floor of the Senate, every single proposal of President Obama's that would have undermined the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms was voted down on the floor of the Senate. I'm grateful for Chuck Grassley's leadership in that fight. I'm grateful for Rand Paul's leadership in that fight. But I'm most grateful for your leadership in that fight. Because we couldn't get any of that done without you. And that shifts to the second piece. What should we be doing? We should champion growth and opportunity. My top priority in office is restoring economic growth, because growth is foundational to every other challenge. You want to turn around unemployment? You want to turn around the national debt? You want to maintain the strongest military in the world to protect our national security? You've got to have growth. The last 4 years, our economy has averaged 0.9% growth a year. To put that in perspective, there's only one other period since World War II of four consecutive years of less than 1% GDP growth. That was 1979 to 1982. It was coming out of the Jimmy Carter administration. It was the same failed economic policies of out-of-control spending and taxes and regulation, and it produced the exact same economic stagnation. I think the top priority of every elected official, Republican or Democrat, this should be a bipartisan objective, is to get our economy moving again, to get it growing again, to get it strong. And there are three ways you do so. Number one, you finally rein in out-of-control spending and unsustainable debt. You know, back last fall, I had the opportunity to speak at the Republican convention in Tampa. And I talked about the national debt. I talked about our two little girls, Caroline and Catherine. And afterwards, I went back to the hotel room about 1:30 in the morning. I pulled out my iPhone, began looking at Twitter. And it so happened that Paula Poundstone, the comedian, was watching the convention that night. I guess she didn't have anything better to do. And she sent a tweet. She said, Ted Cruz just said, when his daughter was born, the national debt was $10 trillion. Now it's $16 trillion. What the heck did she do? Which Heidi and I laughed so hard we almost fell out of bed. You know, Caroline is 5 years old. In her short life, our national debt has grown over 60%. What we're doing is fundamentally immoral. Our parents didn't do that to us. Their parents didn't do that to them. No generation in the history of this country has given their children such crushing debt that it exceeds the size of our entire economy. Our kids and grandkids, if we keep going down this path, will spend their entire lives working not to meet the challenges they face, but to pay off the debt that their parents and grandparents racked up because we couldn't live within our means. You want to know why the American people are fed up with politicians in Washington? And let me be clear, it's politicians in both parties who have gotten us in this mess. The second element of restoring growth and opportunity is fundamental tax reform. Now, we've all seen the scandals of the IRS targeting conservative groups, Tea Party groups, pro-life groups, targeting groups that use offensive words like liberty, constitution, bill of rights. You know, I think it's actually right that they recognize those words are a threat to what they were doing. And as problematic as what they were doing was, and let me be clear, when Richard Nixon tried to use the IRS to target his political enemies, it was wrong, and it was rightly decried in a bipartisan manner. And when the Obama administration did the same thing, it is every bit as wrong. But let me tell you, as bad as that scandal is, it underscores what I think is a far more fundamental and simple solution, which is we need to abolish the IRS. Now, let me tell you something. In Washington, D.C., there's a technical term for what I just said. That's called crazy talk. It's the people out there on the fringe that talk about it. Why? Because there is an army of lobbyists on K Street who make a living putting exemptions into the IRS code. There are more words in the IRS code than there are in the Bible. Not a one of them is as good. Anyone know the shortest scripture in the Bible? There has been a lot of weeping because of the IRS. But listen, if you have to depend on elected officials in Washington, the IRS will not be abolished. There is only one way that we will actually succeed in abolishing the IRS, and that is it's the same way we won the drone fight, it's the same way we won the gun fight, which is there is no politician in Washington that can win this fight. I can't win this fight. Chuck can't win this fight. No elected official can. The only people who can win this fight are the men and women across America. If millions upon millions of Americans come together at the grassroots and demand of our elected officials, stand for principle. Stop going down this road that is bankrupting the country and threatening the future for our kids and grandkids. That's the only thing that can do it, is the American people demanding it. And I am working very, very hard to encourage and mobilize the American people to do exactly that. The third way we restore economic growth is regulatory reform, reducing the armies of regulators like locusts. Actually, locusts are more friendly. And you can use pesticide against locusts. Pesticide doesn't work nearly as well against regulators. But to stop the army of regulators who are destroying small businesses, destroying economic growth. And there is no regulatory reform more important than repealing every single word of Obamacare. Yes. Now, I am here right now to enlist your help. We are getting ready to have an epic battle on Obamacare. Now, you may have read, Congress has voted, I don't know, 38, 39, 506 times to repeal Obamacare. But none of those votes were binding. None of those votes got passed into law. So it's one thing to vote when it's a symbolic gesture that you can go back to your constituents and say, hey, I voted to do it. It's another thing to vote when you can actually get it done. This fall, we have an opportunity to defund Obamacare. In September, the continuing resolution that funds the federal government expires. I have publicly pledged, along with a number of other senators, that under no circumstances will I vote for a continuing resolution that funds one penny of Obamacare.
Amen.
Now, our framers knew what they were doing when they crafted the Constitution. Thomas Jefferson said, "The Constitution serves as chains to bind the mischief of government." One of the most important restraints the Constitution has is Congress has the power of the purse. And it is a very effective restraint to restrain an out-of-control executive. If we do one of two things, if we hold 41 Republicans in the United States Senate, or if we hold 218 Republicans in the House of Representatives, we can defund Obamacare in September. And I'll point out, this is the last fight we'll have on this before Obamacare starts going into full force in January. Now, just a couple of weeks ago, as you know, President Obama unilaterally and in defiance of the law decided to postpone the employer mandate until conveniently after the 2014 election. Now, I'll make 2 points about that. Number one, the fact that they moved it until after the election, and I'm going to suggest that timing was not accidental, is an incredible admission. It is an incredible... If Obamacare were a good thing, they'd want it before the election. If it were working, if it is, as Harry Reid said on national television Sunday, Obamacare has been wonderful for the American people. If that were true, why on earth would they move it after the election? It is an admission from the president that just as the lead author of Obamacare, Democratic Senator Max Baucus, said, Obamacare is becoming a train wreck. The wheels are coming off. But secondly, what the Obama administration did was postpone it for large companies with 50 employees or more. Why is it that big corporations get a special exemption, a special benefit that the American people are not given, that hardworking families and taxpayers are not given, and that's why we need to defund every bit of it for every American? Now, is this going to be easy? The two things I just put out there, abolishing the IRS and defunding Obamacare, are, I don't know if any of you in the sort of business consultant world have heard of a phrase called BHAGs. BHAG is short for Big Hairy Audacious Goal. Those are big, hairy, audacious goals for the American people. I got to tell you right now, if either one of those came to a vote right now in Congress, we'd lose. We do not have the votes in the Senate. We don't have the votes in the House. And I'm going to tell you as well, there's nothing I can do to change that. I can argue till I'm blue in the face, and it is not within my capacity to persuade 41 Senate Republicans or 218 House Republicans. But you can. The way we get this done, and the entire terrain has changed, the way we get this done is the American people stand together. We come together as grassroots activists, and we demand of our elected officials, enough is enough. Stop talking. Start acting. You know, I'm reminded of back in 2001, I worked in the Department of Justice. John Ashcroft, my boss there, said the following. He said, if I'm ever accused of being a Christian, I'd like for there to be enough evidence to convict me. I think the same thing is true, that we need our leaders to demonstrate, not by telling us we're with you, but by standing up and acting. And the only way that will happen is if the grassroots demand it of our elected officials. I want to close by sharing with you, this is a room of men and women who love this country, men and women who love liberty. And for all of us, liberty is not some abstract concept we learn and read about in a high school textbook. Liberty is something that is real in our own lives. It's something that means something to each and every one of us. And it has something to do with all of our collective family stories. For me, that's very much true. My dad is from Cuba. He was born in Cuba. He grew up in Cuba. When he was a teenager, when he was 14, he started fighting in the Cuban Revolution. He spent 4 years fighting in the revolution. He was thrown in prison and tortured when he was 17 years old. He was beaten almost to death. To this day, his front teeth are not his own because they were kicked out of his mouth in a Cuban jail when he was a teenager. In 1957, my dad fled Cuba, fled the Batista regime, and came to Texas. He was 18. He couldn't speak English. He had $100 sewn into his underwear. Actually, don't advise carrying money in your underwear. And he got a job washing dishes. Why did he wash dishes? Because you didn't have to speak English. You just had to stick dishes under hot water. He made 50 cents an hour, paid his way through the University of Texas, got a job, went on to start a small business, worked towards the American dream. Today, my dad is a pastor in Dallas. My dad's been my hero my whole life, and he's here today. Rafael Cruz, please stand up. When I was a kid, my dad would say to me over and over again, when we faced oppression in Cuba, I had a place to flee to. If we lose our freedom here, where do we go? There is no place to go. That's why all of us are here. You know what I find most incredible about my dad's story? How commonplace it is. Every one of us has a story just like that in our background, whether it's us or our parents or our great-great-great-grandparents. We are all the children of those who risked everything for freedom. And I think that's the most fundamental DNA of what it means to be an American, is to value freedom and opportunity above all else. That's what we're fighting for. That's why we're here. And I'll tell you, I am incredibly honored and blessed to have the opportunity to be side by side with you, fighting together to take our country back, to restore that shining city on a hill that is the United States of America. Thank you, and God bless you. And now I am happy to answer or dodge any questions you like. Yes, sir.
Well, Senator, I really appreciate your goals, and I appreciate you being here and your leadership. One topic that's important to me, as you failed to mention, is in light of Edward Snowden's heroic revelations, it's become abundantly clear that America is constructing a police state which is more advanced and sophisticated than anything ever the Stasi or Heinrich Himmler could have dreamed of. So as a U.S. Senator, what are you going to do to protect my Fourth Amendment, protect the notion of privacy, and hold the NSA accountable for all this?
I appreciate the question you ask, and I'll tell you, I am concerned about a pattern across this government of collecting more and more information about private citizens, about law-abiding citizens. Now, I think in terms of addressing it, we need to be cautious about the level of rhetoric we employ in the public sphere. I think there are enormous differences between what the federal government is doing and what Nazi Germany did and other nations. I do think it is critical that we preserve our constitutional liberties. And I'll tell you, with Edward Snowden, I have tried very much to say, let's take some time to ascertain what exactly the federal government's doing, what the policies are, and there are twin objectives that I believe most Americans want. Number one, the federal government has a responsibility to protect our national security, and in particular to combat radical Islamic terrorists. And I will note that it says something that we have a president of the United States who seems unwilling to utter the words radical Islamic terrorist. I have concerns about the approach of this administration on two fronts. One, it seems that they sweep far too willingly law-abiding citizens, Americans, into their sweep of information. But two, they have been, on multiple occasions, less than effective in actually connecting the dots and going after radical Islamic terrorists. If you look, for example, at the Boston bombings, we were notified by Russia about these brothers, about their being potentially radical Islamic terrorists. We went and investigated, and then by all appearances dropped the ball. The older brother posted a YouTube video that seemed to advocate jihad, and that apparently raised no red flags. And I have a real concern why it was that our federal government was not able to connect the dots and prevent that horrific act of terrorism. I'll tell you, in Texas, in Fort Hood, Major Hassan, who murdered other soldiers, again, there were red flags. You had a major in the Army who was communicating with a known terrorist asking about the permissibility of murdering fellow servicemen, who was giving a presentation to fellow soldiers about radical Islam and embracing jihad, and again, it seems we dropped the ball. My view is that we need to be vigorous protecting the national security of the United States, and that means finding and stopping radical Islamic terrorists, and at the same time, we need to protect the constitutional rights of law-abiding citizens, and I believe both of those are possible and indeed are serving the same ultimate objective.
Supposedly it's a jazzed up form of the Senate bill. Of course, my concern is if the Senate, Congress passes any kind of amnesty bill, it's going to divide the public party. So what about this House bill? I mean, it doesn't appear to be any better job. Maybe I'm wrong.
Look, I share your concerns. The question was about immigration, and then let me just address immigration more broadly. On immigration, I am both optimistic and pessimistic, which may be a sign I've been in Washington too long. I'm optimistic because I think there's actually a lot of bipartisan agreement on many aspects of immigration reform. I think outside of Washington, there's overwhelming bipartisan agreement that our immigration system is broken, that we've got to get serious about securing the borders and stopping illegal immigration, that it doesn't make any sense in a post 9/11 world, we don't know who's coming into this country, we don't know their criminal backgrounds. And I think there is overwhelming bipartisan agreement that we need to improve and streamline legal immigration, that we need to remain a nation that doesn't just welcome, that celebrates legal immigrants. Americans by choice is what President Reagan referred to legal immigrants as. If Congress focused on an immigration bill that focused on those areas of bipartisan agreement, we could have a bill that would sail through Congress. So why am I pessimistic? I am pessimistic because I don't believe President Obama wants to pass an immigration bill. I think his principal objective is political rather than actually passing it. And in particular, the most politically divisive element of this bill is a path to citizenship for the 11 million people who are here illegally. And, you know, if you look back, in 1986 was the last time Congress passed immigration reform. And in 1986, Congress told the American people, we got a deal for you. We're going to grant amnesty to the 3 million people who are currently here illegally. And in exchange, we're going to secure the border. We're going to stop illegal immigration. We're going to fix the problem. And the American people, by and large, said, okay, we'll take that deal. Now, we all know what happened. The amnesty happened, and the border never got secured. And now, three decades later, instead of 3 million people here illegally, there are roughly 11 million people here illegally. And I'll tell you, among many of those people are human tragedies. This is a terrible, broken system. You know, I encourage anyone interested in immigration, come down to the Texas border with me. Visit with the farmers and ranchers on the border who no longer lock their homes because every week they have people coming illegally across, and they'll break into their houses desperate for food or water because they're on the brink of death. This current system, you have women and children entrusting themselves to coyotes, to drug dealers, being sexually assaulted, being left to die in the desert. And visit with one of these ranchers who regularly encounters the bodies of those who died desperately seeking freedom and trying to come to this country. Nobody who was interested in a humane system would want a system that encourages future illegal immigration. And the Gang of Eight bill, which I worked very hard to improve, and when they weren't willing to improve it, to stop it, continues the same mistakes of the past. It offers the same deal that was offered in 1986, legalization now, and sometime maybe in the future, we'll secure the border. And if that bill became law, 10, 20, 30 years from now, we'd be right back, except instead of 11 million people, we'd have 20 million or 30 million people, and the same discussion would go on. I think what the American people want is to fix the system. And I think what President Obama and the Obama White House wants is for the bill to be voted down in the House of Representatives, because they want a political issue in 2014 and 2016. And I'll tell you, to my mind, the clarifying moment of the entire immigration debate occurred during the Judiciary Committee markup. I introduced a whole series of amendments to improve this bill. One amendment to put real teeth in border security, that was rejected. One amendment was to eliminate the path to citizenship for the 11 million people who are here illegally. Now, that amendment left the underlying provisions of the bill that provided a legal work permit after the border was secured. And Senator Chuck Schumer responded, and he said, if there is no citizenship, there can be no reform. And I actually took the opportunity to thank Senator Schumer, to thank him for his candor. I said, you know, Senator Schumer has been very, very clear here today. He has stated he has one overarching political goal, and that partisan political goal is more important than every other thing in this bill. He has stated that if he doesn't get 100% of his partisan political bill, he's willing to do nothing to secure the border. He's willing to do nothing to improve high-tech immigration. He's willing to do nothing to help our farmers and ranchers and improve agricultural immigration. And most tellingly, he's willing to do nothing for the 11 million people who are here illegally. He's willing to say, stay in the shadows, because if I don't get every bit of my partisan political goal, I'll take my marbles and go home. Now, that was candid, but I think it was also profoundly cynical. And that's the attitude of the White House. And by the way, this is not hypothetical. If you remember back in 2007, then-Senator Obama played a key role in sticking the knife in immigration reform then at the behest of the union bosses. So right now, Congress is not working to actually fix the system. I think that's what the American people want. It's what I hope the House does. I don't know if they will or not, but I am certainly doing everything I can to encourage them to do exactly that. Yes, ma'am.
I'm sorry. The Senator has time for just one more question, and then they'll be moving to the lower level of the building for a meeting with members of the media. But we do have time for one more. Thank you.
I think many of us are willing to get going on grassroots, and we're really excited about it. I feel like our hands are tied. We don't know what to do. We send our letters to representatives. We send our emails. We call. It just feels like it's going up against a black curtain, and we don't know what happens then.
Right.
Can you give us some advice on how we get going, how we mobilize people, some suggestions of activities we can all participate in?
It's a great question. There are lots of things, and one of the things I'm trying to do is help and encourage that. So, for example, in the immigration fight, we started a website, secureborders.now.com, for a national petition, urge people all over the country to come and sign up on secureborders.now.com to say, secure the borders first, fix the problem, don't repeat the mistakes of the past. Getting involved and engaged that way makes a difference. As you may know, I'm participating in ads that are running nationally to abolish the IRS, and urging people to call in and sign up together to mobilize the grassroots. And let me give an example of what the grassroots can do, because much of it, from my end, I'm trying to help facilitate, encourage that, but to be honest, nobody can do it as well as you can, as well as each of you organically reaching out to people you know and trust. Nothing has the impact like someone you know and respect and trust saying, listen, here's the truth. Here's what we need to do. And let me give you an encouraging anecdote. So about a month ago, I was in New York speaking at the New York Republican Party at their annual fundraiser. And we had three groups of protesters there. We had one group that was protesting on immigration, one group that was protesting because they favored gun control, and then we actually had another gun group that was protesting because I was willing to talk to the New York Republicans who were not very stout in defending the Second Amendment. So it was interesting to get protested from both ends of that. A group of liberal activists decided they were going to do what's called a Twitter bomb, that at the time I was speaking, they were going to launch liberal activists all over the country to tweet, you Cruz, you lose. In response, a group of conservative grassroots activists decided they were going to counter it. They were going to do a Twitter bomb of their own. And the campaign was at 5:30 Wednesday night, same time as the liberals were doing it, they were going to urging people to tweet, Cruz to victory. By 9 o'clock Wednesday night, the hashtag Cruz to victory was trending number one in the United States and number two worldwide. And the liberal attack didn't make the top 10 lists. Now, the beauty of that was entirely organic. We didn't prompt that. We didn't organize it. We didn't do anything. That came from the people. I got to tell you, some of y'all may have seen a senior Republican some time ago referred to me and to Rand Paul as wacko birds. And my response to that was not to reciprocate, not to launch any insult the other way, but simply to say, if standing for liberty and the Constitution make you a wacko bird, count me a proud wacko bird. In response to that, grassroots activists have begun showing up at events with T-shirts that say Wacko Bird across the front. In my Senate office, I have a baseball cap with a picture of Daffy Duck and the words Wacko Bird that a grassroots activist made and showed up and gave it to me. Look, we the people, when we stand together, can do incredible things. And I would encourage each of you organically with your friends to organize, to use social media, to get engaged. Calling your elected representatives has a powerful impact, and standing for principle, urging them to stand for specific principle, makes a real difference. And I appreciate everything you're doing. Thank you, and God bless you.